Final case of the morning is United States against Jones. Wait till your adversary manages to find a seat. Ms. Joseph.
May it please the court. My name is Nancy Joseph. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Tremaine Jones. Your Honors, Mr. Jones pled guilty to being a felon in possession of a firearm on October 4, 2001. However, he was sentenced as if he was being sentenced for a murder that occurred some 4 days earlier. While that is acceptable and allowed under the guidelines via the mechanism of the homicide cross-reference, it was improper for it to be applied here for two reasons. The first is that the court misinterpreted the relationship between the relevant guidelines section and the homicide cross-reference, because the starting point for applying the homicide cross-reference has to be and is the relevant conduct section. The second reason, Your Honors, is that the court failed to make any findings that this defendant, Mr. Jones, his conduct, his actions, set into motion the events that resulted in death. As to the first, regarding the relevant conduct is the framework. It's the starting point, as I said before. The relevant conduct is the general principle. It says if you want to look at conduct that is outside the charged offense, and here the felony possession
charge. The charged offense is possession of the gun despite a prior felony, and that offense was being committed on the day of the murder just as it was being committed on the day of the arrest. I mean, the structure of your argument seems to be that the offense of possession is committed only at the instant of arrest. But that's not right. It's committed during the entire course of possession.
He was indicted for possessing the firearm, for being a felon in possession of the firearm on October 4th. The other offense, which is the September 30th offense, when we have in deciding...
Possession is an offense that lasts as long as the possession. Not an offense that where, for example, each day of possession is a separate crime. You don't want your client to be indicted separately and cumulatively punished for every day of possession, do you?
No, I don't, Your Honor. But on this record, Your Honor, we do not know whether Mr. Jones continued to possess the firearm from September.
Is there any evidence that he, say, sold it and then bought it back in this 4-day span?
No, Your Honor, there is no such evidence on the record, but there's also no evidence that he continued to possess it from September 30th on.
So he admitted possessed that. It on one day, possessed it 4 days later. That's good evidence that he possessed it continuously. That's usually how we prove something is possessed continuously.
But, Your Honor, there's no evidence on what happened in the interim between September 30th and all the way to October 4th. While it may be reasonable that he did have it the entire time, but on this record, there's no such evidence that he did.
Well, isn't there's no dispute he possessed this gun at the time of the, whatever you want to call it, robbery and subsequent murder of whoever it was they robbed.
No, Your Honor.
So he had that gun, even though he didn't use it. He used it, but he didn't shoot the dead person. So what is the dispute here as far as you're saying they have to prove that he had it every day between the time he admits or it's undisputed that he had it during the murder and when he's caught?
Your Honor, there's no dispute because he admits that the gun that I possess on October 4th, I also possess on September 30th.
At the time of the crime.
At the time of the crime. Yeah. The dispute is, Your Honor, is the relationship between the two incidents. The relevant conduct guidelines tell us that the other offense has to be acts or omissions that are in preparation, occurring during the course of the offense, or in order to avoid detection of the offense. The September 30th conduct, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that October 4th conduct is the offense of conviction. That's
when
the indictment.
Got caught.
That's when he got caught, but he was indicted for possessing it on that day, not on September 30th. So the September 30th conduct, the question has to be, was that conduct in preparation, occurring during the course of, or in order to detect the conduct occurring on October 4th? And the answer to all of those questions is no. I guess the second part of the relevant conduct is, as the previous question alludes to, well, was it continuous? Was it part of the same common scheme and plan? And to that, it's the second part of the relevant conduct section. And usually common scheme and plan is reserved for conduct that are grouped.
Well, suppose that it was undisputed that at the time of the murder, when his brother murdered this person and he was part of the operation, that he had a different gun. And then on the 4th, he's running from the cops, they finally catch up with him. But it's undisputed he has a different gun. Then there would be no connection. Would that be correct?
I agree, there would be no connection. It was a
different gun. But he would still be a felon in possession. Only there's no, does that improve your argument or does it make any difference?
I think it is different, Your Honor, because he was a felon in possession on October 4th for possessing the gun that day. He was a felon in possession of September 30th. I guess then the next question would be, Your Honor, well, how is he charged for possessing on October 4th? If he's charged as he was here for possessing a firearm on October 4th, what is the relationship between the conduct that happened on September 30th?
Well, and if he had a different gun, there wouldn't be any, would there?
No.
If he had the same gun, that seems to be where the relationship is, isn't it?
If he had the same gun, Your Honor...
that he used in that crime. He didn't shoot anybody, but he brandished it, whatever he did.
It's a different, Your Honor, yes, I agree, it's a different offense. Possessing October 4th and possessing it on September 30th. I guess the linchpin for me, Your Honor, is not so much that, although it's an important factor, that whether or not it was the same gun or not. Here was the same gun. But what other factors do we look at? What's happening on September 30th, and how does it relate to October 4th? Then I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Bertrand.
May it please the court, my name is Joy Bertrand, and I represent the United States of America in this matter. As in United States versus Corbin, Tremaine Jones' sentence, which applied the homicide cross-reference, reflects an enhancement that simply reflects the gravity of the circumstances surrounding his possession of the firearm, and thus reflects the common sense notion that one who puts a firearm to a nefarious use deserves a sentence more harsh than one who does no more than possess the gun.
No, the example I gave had a different gun at the time of this murder. Would that change the charge?
Your Honor, I think it would both...
Obviously, you'd get charged for twice possessing two guns, but maybe just hypothetically.
Right. Hypothetically speaking, I think that it would create a different indictment because of the two separate guns charged, and would also create some issues surrounding the holding in Ritzema, where this court had some serious problems with the defendant being charged with silencers and then having those silencers kind of found to be once, twice removed from the sexual assault of the defendant, committed with a gun that also could be attached to the silencers, and I think that would create a separate problem.
You mean that there's the time, let's say several months had passed, for instance, and they stop him at a Terry stop or something, and they discover this gun, and discover he's a potential, he is a felon in possession, and then going way back to some distant crime, would it still apply, even though he's, see, in this one he was caught when they were looking for him for this particular crime?
Your Honor, I think it would...
Well, I'm not sure Ritzman would apply.
Okay, well, thank you, and you wrote it. thank you. This hypothetical I've turned over in my mind as well, and I think it would really depend on the entire circumstances of the case. In terms of this case, I can't speak for my supervisors, but I don't know if I personally, as the prosecutor, would have been comfortable making the arguments that I can and am strongly supporting.
What is the August 28th indictment related to? That was also a felon in possession indictment.
Yes, sir. That was a completely separate incident where the defendant was spotted outside a house that was suspected to be involved with some drug dealing. He led chase in that case. He threw down a gun. They caught him coming down a gangway.
So he couldn't have continued to possess that gun. He
correct.
Got rid of it.
That gun had been seized. That had the ammunition in his pocket.
And well, I mean, that gun is not...
That is a non-issue. With the gun itself is a non-issue. I think here what is particularly telling is that...
However, he was released to a halfway house.
Yes, sir.
And then left involuntary. I mean...
He excused himself, yes.
He excused himself, right.
And according to his Miranda statement... and I believe this was discussed in the sentencing hearing, he then procured for himself another gun on the street. He said a couple days before the armed robbery and shooting of Jamarcus Beck. So if he left the halfway house on or about September 26th, there's a four-day lead time where he manages to procure a new gun, and that's the gun that we recover on October 4th. What I think is missing in the defendant's assertion is that the defendant is continuing to evade arrest, not only for his now federal warrant for excusing himself from the halfway house, but also evading arrest for the homicide of Jamarcus Beck. And here's what's telling about that. The officers, according to their testimony at sentencing, state that they go to the area of 8th and Concordia Street looking for the suspect. They even take a tactical unit. They go to the door of his house and encounter the defendant's brother. Meanwhile, the defendant comes walking up the street. They recognize the defendant as the person that they suspect to be one of the actors in this armed robbery. He leads chase, evading arrest, clearly knowing that he's in big trouble, throws down this gun, which they catch, they find in his path as he's scaling a fence. So, that's the major issue that the defendant cannot overcome. This offense is still ongoing in terms of him continuing to evade arrest for it. When they flee the scene on September 30th and leave Jamarcus Beck dying, the offense doesn't end entirely for the application of the homicide cross-reference. He continues to hide out from the police, hide out with his brother, carry the gun, and when he does see the police, continue to flee. That's when the story ends.
So this is a continuing crime, then, the way you describe it. I don't know. He's possessing at the time he's caught, but you
correct.
You tie it to the earlier crime where that you incorporate into this cross-reference.
I only in terms of applying the cross-reference and looking at the relevant conduct and looking at the language of the cross-reference. His status continued throughout this four-day time period as well. He didn't suddenly have all of his prior felony issues resolved at the Court of Appeals and was no longer a felon. That status continued. He continued to be an indicted person, although he was not charged as one. Jermaine Jones, in this case, faces the full penalty of possessing that firearm and the activities in which he conducted himself while possessing that firearm. And there is no doubt about that. One thing that I think is also telling about this firearm is in his confession to the detectives, he states that he and his brother planned this. This was not a spur of the moment. Oh, that looks like a good idea. Let's rob those guys. They planned it. Excuse me. Sorry. They recruit Rashad Cotton, the driver of the truck. Rashad even says, I have to run, I have to go someplace. I'll be back in an hour. That gives them time to think about it. At that time, both Jermaine Jones and his brother are armed. They then drive around looking for their victims. Again, they're armed. This was not a spontaneous act. This was a planned and deliberate action done by the defendant, taking into consideration that he was armed in addition to his brother. That's important when looking at the second issue raised by the defendant in terms of this set in motion standard. And the government, as it asserted in its brief, maintains that that is not the proper standard. The proper standard for evaluating whether or not this homicide cross-reference should apply is set forth in both the Thomas case and the Walls case. And that is, to determine if death resulted, the sentencing court must ascertain if the defendant his conduct was intentional or reckless, and B, if death was a foreseeable risk of the defendant's conduct. An armed robbery is definitely involved. An armed robbery definitely involves that foreseeable risk that somebody's going to die. One of the cases that is particularly illuminating is the White case, which also originated out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, where the defendant recruited a young woman, I believe she was a minor, to work for him as a prostitute, and he would farm her out. He last sees her leaving with a client in a car. She is then found dead in Dane County. I think that's three counties over. The government was never able to place the homicide on the defendant. However, at sentencing, the homicide cross-reference applied because this court found that the activity that the defendant had engaged this girl in created that foreseeable risk. That same foreseeable risk was created by the defendant's activity on September 30th, and Jamarcus Beck was the subject of that risk.
Counsel, let me ask you.
Yes, sir.
It's aside, I'm just raising curiosity. And that August 28th felon possession, how did he end up in a halfway house?
Your Honor, the defendant appeared before the magistrate judge. The government asked that the defendant be detained based on his prior criminal record and the offense at issue. The magistrate court found that it would be more appropriate and still protect the interest of the community for the defendant to be released to the halfway house with strict conditions.
Thank you.
Does the court have any more questions of the government?
Mm-hmm.
At this time, I would ask for the excuse then, please.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bertrand. Anything further, Ms. Joseph?
Your Honor, while it is true that Mr. Jones remained in the status of being a felon, the offense of conviction that he was charged and indicted for was for being a felon and possessing a firearm on October 4th, and that is what he pled guilty to. In order to look outside of that, out of the charge offense to real offense, the relevant conduct principles must be applied, and for reasons stated in my brief, and I've argued earlier, the factors that the relevant conduct guideline tells us to look at are not present here. In regards to going beyond looking at the relevant conduct and finding if death resulted, the court must also look at whether Mr. Jones' conduct set into motion the events that resulted in death. Now, foreseeability, whether his actions were intentional, in both Walls and Smith and Thomas, the court has explained that to mean whether the defendant's action set the events resulting death into motion. In this case, Mr. Jones, that is Tremaine Jones, was not the person who exited the car. He was not the person who approached the victim. He was not the person whose gun shot the victim. In fact, he fired no guns, and he fired no bullets at all. He did not shoot at all. When you contrast that to Walls, in the Walls case, although Walls himself did not, his bullet was not found to be the bullet that killed the person, but he initiated the action. He gathered his best friends to go to the victim's house, and he fired. Here, Mr. Jones' action did not set into motion. And in looking outside of the offense that he pled guilty, the question is, how far do we go? Well, the relevant conduct tells us how far we should go, and those principles are not applicable here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance to both your client and us. The case is taken under advisement.